This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men, real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KBOO. Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st in Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422. Once again, that's 503-288-3422.
Drawn out because you had no place to go. There ain't nobody higher right here since I'm driving down to Mexico. I reckon that learning self-trade made me see the world. Moved to the city someday.
Steve Earle this morning from the Revolution Starts Now CD, and that piece, of course, Rich Man's War, because that's what we're dealing with right now. My name is Marlena Smith. It is 4 minutes after the hour of 9. You're tuned to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band right here in Portland. And, of course, we have the next 2 hours ahead of us. I have Eddie G in the studio. We'll be talking for the first hour about the intersection of culture and politics. Then in the second hour, Howard Lyman, the Mad Cow Rancher, will be live in the studio. We'll be talking about all the issues around mad cow disease, Howard's latest tour, his books, DVDs, etc. Kind of do an update on whether or not you should eat that steak, given the barbecue season is on the run here. Also want to let you know the sun will be going into Aries on Monday, which is also known as the vernal equinox, which is also known as the beginning of spring in the northern hemisphere, and of course the beginning of fall on the other side of the equator. That means there will be equal hours of day and night, and if you look at any of the places such as the Weather Channel or the paper that list the amount of or the time the sun rises and sets, it's actually about 12 hours right now, so we're really in the zone of that change. And we'll be shifting from water to fire, which is a different kind of energy, much more intensity, more intellectual, less emotional, less watery. And in 2 weeks, we'll be setting the clocks ahead. Okay, so I think I have Eddie G. here on one of these lines. Eddie?
Good morning.
Keep talking.
Hello, hello, hello.
I gotcha.
Testes 1-2.
Yes, well, that's very nice. Rich Man's War.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are going to get together today and talk. And one of the first things that I wanted to talk about is the question of whether or not the rich men should continue to be in power and continue their war effort, which takes us immediately to the Resolution for Censure by Russ Feingold this week.
Well, if you have the right rich men, and it doesn't matter how much money they have in the bank, it's what they have between the ears that really counts. We just have the wrong ones in, and we've had the wrong ones in for quite a while. Not every rich man is George Soros, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
George Soros being the billionaire who usually bankrolls progressive causes. What we have now is a group of people for whom political power is merely a means to an end, and the end that they're seeking is more money. They want to control everything. They want to control the world's economy one way or another. They've been losing control of that through the 20th century by things like unions, by things like loss of cheap labor, by things like loss of cheap resources in third world countries, because third world countries are starting to come to consciousness. And now in the 21st century, they're fighting to regain their position as the strong white men who run the world, and it's something they've lost over the last 100 years. And so that I think that's part of what we're seeing right now. The President of the United States is basically a ventriloquist dummy. He's an inflatable doll that they move around from place to place and says what they want him to say. And the powers that be run it. When you have a Vice President of the United States who's still making money off Halliburton, and every time Halliburton gets a contract, it fattens his wallet, you wonder, why are there so many Halliburton contracts? Well, duh.
Didn't he shoot somebody?
I heard that.
Didn't the guy apologize for being shot?
I suppose, yes.
Yeah.
I thought I heard that story. The one thing I thought of was that, if I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. He was using birdshot, which is what you do to shoot quail. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you shoot it with buckshot, you'll have the head and the tail left, and the bird will be gone.
Mm-hmm.
So he used this teeny little shot.
Mm-hmm.
If he had shot Whittington in the face with buckshot, the guy would be dead.
Mm-hmm.
And even in Texas, that's negligent homicide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I'm thinking is, would they really have tried the Vice President of the United States in Texas for negligent homicide?
Nah. Nah, he's got buddies in Wyoming. It's all the same. The issue of censure, the resolution for censure, of course,
yeah.
came from Russ Feingold.
Hey, Russ.
From Wisconsin, a legislator with a Harvard Law degree. He's a Rhodes Scholar. I looked him up in the Political Almanac. From the Jewish tradition, long-term marriage. He's a Pisces, just for people who like to know this sort of thing. And he is known in the Senate as a guy who, well, the term they use is a maverick term. But in reality, he's also viewed as a gentleman who has novel arguments. He's very liberal on culture and foreign policy. He's moderate on the economy. He, along with McCain, sponsored the ban on soft money for political contributions. And he fights spending excesses in the Pentagon and in the oil companies. So those have been his traditional positions. What's also interesting about this is that he stood alone initially, and the Democrats were eerily silent. We all wondered what that was about. And then a couple days ago, I heard that Barbara Boxer had signed on. And then the New York Times finally ran an article, because I was watching to see if the print media would cover this. And it didn't come on the front page of the New York Times until Barbara Boxer signed on. And then it became a story. And the story, which was a front page story, basically argues that this is a real plus for the Republican Party, that the right-wing talk show hosts are using this as a way of aligning the Democrats with terrorism. I think it's a scurrilous argument. But there is this question of the reluctance of the Democrats, and it really made me wonder how cowed they are. And I really am struggling to understand why it would be so difficult for them to align themselves with Russ Feingold. What are your thoughts?
They have no guts.
Well, that's one possibility.
I understand that Feingold's a brilliant guy. Feingold knows how to reach across the aisle. He's worked with people from across the aisle before. He has a certain amount of respect from that side of the aisle. But this is all politics in an election year. Russ Feingold that was a fairly quixotic thing to do, in the sense that he probably didn't think he was going to get anything out of it except mention in the press. And the Republican spin machine turned it into, well, now he's made the president the enemy. Well, no, that's not what he did. What he said was the president broke the law and should be censured, just like Clinton was censured for breaking the law, lying in a deposition. He lied to the American people, blah, blah, blah. You understand all the arguments. The Democrats failed to support him because they don't want to be tainted with the Republican charge that they're soft on terror, especially since they're doing so well in the polls against the Republicans now. The president's poll numbers are dreadful. The Republican Congress's poll numbers are pretty dreadful. And the Democrats come out ahead of both the president and the Republicans in Congress in the polls, and they don't want to jeopardize that because they want to win back at least one house of the Congress, but presumably the House of Representatives.
Okay.
Was that too much of an answer?
No, that's a good answer, and I want to hang on to that idea because I want to address this in just a minute. But before we do, I want to continue this discussion about what Feingold did, because even though it might look like he was kind of a shot in the dark, there is a group called Impeach Pack, a grassroots group based in New York City, and I'm looking at yesterday's New York Times. John Conyers, the representative from Michigan, who's been on the Judiciary Committee since Richard Nixon was impeached, and John Conyers, along with the Black Congressional Caucus, are the people who have held on to civil liberties and a constitutional perspective throughout many, many crises in my adult life. He has pushed for censure or impeachment of Mr. Bush over this war. So Feingold really isn't alone. Then there's this Impeach Pack. Several local governments, including San Francisco, Santa Cruz, Arcata, California, have called for, and several towns in Vermont have passed resolutions calling for impeachment. Harper's Magazine, Garrison Keillor, former Watergate figure John Dean, Barbara Streisand, actor Richard Dreyfuss, etc. So it's not, that's not a big cast, but it's not as though he's operating alone. And then at the end, there's an interesting piece that notes that while this might look bizarre to some people, Father Drinan, a Democrat of Massachusetts, and a handful of others like John Conyers in 1972, similarly were planning for the impeachment of Nixon. When the moment of truth came, they were ready.
Yeah,
so there is that to be said.
Well, the obvious response from the right wing is, well, it's the same usual suspects. Number one, Barbara Streisand and Garrison Keillor, and John Dean, the recent convert to progressivism. He's been making the rounds of the progressive talk shows, talking up his book, which is the thesis of which is that the current administration is far worse than the Nixon administration was during Watergate. That they're far more vile, they're far more crooked, they're far more corrupt, and they're far more dangerous. So he's found a new audience, and I don't deny that. I think John Dean was a hero in 1972, and he's a hero now. But again, the Republicans say, well, this was just a masturbatory feel-good thing that Feingold did, and he's getting support from the usual cast of characters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that Feingold did that was a great service in the resolution for censure that he raised is that because there were many other things he could have used for censure resolution or even impeachment. And for people who are wondering, impeachment is the equivalent of being indicted in a regular court of law.
Exactly.
And an acquittal is the way you get out of it, which is what happened to Clinton. A censure is a much lesser statement, but it is part of the historical record, and it indicates that there were people who criticized this president's abuse of the Constitution.
It means nothing, really, except to say that we didn't like what you did.
Right, and it's an historical fact that can't be removed from the books anymore.
Right.
But the things that were concerning Russ Feingold were the way the White House wavered on this whole issue of domestic spying, and that's what the censure is about. The first reason they gave for domestic spying was that they had authorization from the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Authority. Then they switched that to they had authority under the war in Afghanistan. And finally, they came up with this inherent right, which was granted to the president by the Constitution in time of war. It is the wavering of the White House on its reasons for spying that has given him, really, I think, the credibility to argue that this is a lie. You know, they're doing this illegally. They can't even come up with a rationale that holds. They keep changing it to try to buy something that will sell it. Therefore, implicitly, they're liars.
Well, this is their modus operandi on everything. They have a position. They take a position. And when that position ceases to hold water anymore, they have a fallback position. And when that thing goes under, they have another fallback position. It was the same way. Why did we go into Iraq? Weapons of mass destruction. No weapons of mass destruction. Well, we went into Iraq because he was going to reconstitute his thing. Well, he wasn't actually going to do that. We're doing it to free the Iraqi people. You know, it's just one position after another. And I've always wondered, did they come up with all these fallback positions at the initial meeting, or did they just make them up on the fly? I mean, I know that Karl Rove can churn this stuff out by the cubic yard. So I imagine they have all this stuff pre-planned. Now, the spying thing, George Bush came to the American people and said, look, when I talk about wiretapping, I'm talking about me going or the Justice Department going and getting a warrant, because you cannot do wiretapping without a warrant. So when you hear wiretapping, remember, we've gone to get a warrant. Well, that was a lie. 100% untrue. He knew it at the time. He was spying at the time, warrantless searches. So that, to me, that's an impeachable offense. That's a high crime and a misdemeanor. But with the current makeup of Congress, nothing's going to happen.
Well, nothing is entirely sure, so we need to keep that door open. But here's another thought that just occurred to me. Subsequent to this call for censure, we've heard a lot in the last few days about White House fatigue and how the president has been so reluctant to change staff, part of which may be related to his paranoia about anybody new coming in that they can't trust. But and I do mean legitimately paranoia. But the other rationale might be that this whole notion of White House fatigue might be just another Karl Rove tactic. If you can argue that people are exhausted, you can explain perhaps, or you can attempt to explain and perhaps even sell it to people who aren't thinking, why there would be three different rationales for the domestic spying episode.
Well, let's back off a little bit, take a little bit of abstract view of this thing. It's the second term. In the second term, you're dealing with a lame duck president. He's a lame duck president, and let's not even remove George Bush from the equation. Any president in George Bush's position right now, a lame duck with polls and near the basement, is not going to have a whole lot of control over his own party. There will be people in the White House, in the White House staff, in the cabinet who are getting antsy, don't want to go down with the sinking ship and be looking to get out, so their attention is wavering. This could happen to any president in George Bush's position, but the fact is it's happening to him, and the fact is that no matter what Karl Rove says, this is endemic to the second-term presidents.
However, with the agenda of this particular White House and the, what can we say, the scandals that are swarming around this White House, keeping it together gets harder and harder.
Yes.
Anybody who's lived a life of lies, you know, the tangled web line, really is apropos to this particular administration. The more pieces you've got floating around out there that you have to cover, the more crises that are erupting. And I mean, and in the middle of all this, Cheney shoots somebody. Things like that keep popping up. It's really a lot of pressure on people who, according to one report, are getting up, you know, at 4 or 5 in the morning every day for 6 years and going to bed at 9 or 10 at night. People like Andy Card, the chief of staff, these people are exhausted.
Andy Card may be on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of McFarlane in the Iran-Contra scandal, yeah, who was ready to lose it, and they, you know, bringing a cake with a key in it to Iran to facilitate the sale of weapons, and they finally put him on Valium during trial, during the hearings, the Iran-Contra hearings, because he was such a wild card, they couldn't control him anymore. He was really losing it. And when people start to lose it, that's when it gets dangerous.
Yeah, that's really true. And I think the same is true of Karl Rove. Now, he may be more relaxed than he was, say, 2 months ago, mm-hmm, when the Valerie Plame thing was,
yeah,
breathing down his neck. But we still don't know how that
right
thing is going to play
right
out. So
he's got a lot of irons in the fire.
He does. And I recall when I was a child, I was very creative and practiced liar. And I stopped lying when I realized that the lies kind of metastasize and you have to create new lies to cover the old lies. And pretty soon you lose track of what the original lie
right.
was and where you are in the process. The tangled web we weave when we practice to deceive, you know, that old poem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening in the White House now, is that they're being consumed by their own lies.
There is another thought I have. There is a whole category of individual known as a sociopathic individual. These are people who behave in ways without any regard for the well-being of others. They're the kind of people that often end up in correctional facilities because they're viewed in the community at large as not being capable of being treated, which may or may not be true, but they are often put in containment because their crimes have a particularly pernicious quality. And again, they show no remorse, at least none that is evident to people who see them. And that may be what we're dealing with, just a big old crowd of sociopaths. So there's that quality. But having said that, sociopaths can be a particularly dangerous breed of individual. These are people who have really damaged childhoods, often come through with something called conduct disorder, where they start as little kids to hurt other people without any remorse because they're so damaged. And that, of course, involves the frontal lobe. It could have a whole lot to do with physical abuse and knocking out important centers that are essential for reasoning and sympathy and all those other factors. But anyway, that makes me really wonder about the Democrats and the silence in their response. I have two, maybe three things kind of cooking around in my brain right now about why the Democrats remain in the background or silent or whatever language we want to use. And you and I have talked about this a little bit. One of them, of course, is this whole notion that they may be dealing with a very dangerous, out-of-control crowd. And nothing about that would surprise me if it were, in fact, true. It's easy for us to stand here and criticize. It's another thing if somebody's threatening you or your family, and we just don't know. But that could be a factor. The second thing about the Democrats, and this was the piece you and I talked about, we live in a pluralistic society. And within that pluralistic society, we're continually assimilating different cultures. And one of the points that you and I discussed in a previous conversation was we've got people moving into this culture, this American society, if you will, the United States, from places that are, what, 8 centuries old?
Culturally?
Culturally,
yeah.
Right. People who are operating on such different wavelengths who have to be assimilated into our culture. And, you know, we reach points of stability, and then, you know, or we did reach points of stability after a lot of the influx after World War II and all of the excesses of Stalin and that sort of thing. Then the culture kind of stabilizes for a while. Then we have this Vietnam War, and we have these wars in Central America, and we have some Mideast stuff going on, and all of a sudden we have a new influx of people into the culture who have to be woven into the fabric. Now, the Republicans, their basic modus operandi is top-down. You do what the guy at the top says. It's very patriarchal. It's very top-down. There's no questions. You fall in line. The Democrats, however, are the party that listens from the bottom up. Now, they don't always act like that, but it is the party of inclusion, and it takes everybody who has something to say. And I mean, that's the theoretical premise of it. So it's much harder to know what kind of an agenda to have if your basic operating principle is you've got a lot more voices to reconcile in any given political moment. And I just wonder how much that plays a part, either one of those plays a part. And I wanted you to just, because you have a cultural background with your anthropology, to talk a little bit about what are we actually assimilating right now at this time in history in our culture?
Well, my people came over at the turn of the 20th century from Romania and Russia. And they came to escape either military service or dreadful conditions economically or dreadful conditions culturally, where Cossacks are regularly running through small villages in Russia and murdering Jews and then, you know, going out and knocking back some vodkas. What we're getting now, the immigration in the second half of the 20th century, it was a very interesting immigration because we were bringing in people from Southeast Asia that had never come in before as a result of the Vietnam War. People were coming here from Cambodia. People were coming here from Thailand. People were coming here from Vietnam. We started assimilating people from the subcontinent of, you know, South Asia, India, Pakistan. When I was in college in the early 60s, we started seeing Indian and Pakistani lab assistants and teaching assistants. They were a novelty in those days. Now, not such a novelty. We started seeing the influx of African students, people from Nigeria, people from Ghana who came to this country to study. But now they're coming over here. There's people coming from Haiti. There's people coming from Central America. There are Muslims coming from Arab countries who are bringing their culture with them. They come to this country for whatever reasons, and they're all good reasons. I put no reason down for coming to this country. This is the place to be. But you cannot expect the United States to be like Yemen. You cannot expect the United States to be like Nigeria. You cannot expect the United States to be like Phnom Penh. It's just not that way. To come here and then say, oh, my God, this is terrible, it doesn't happen that often, let's face it, because people tend, one degree or another, to assimilate. And if they don't assimilate, their children usually do. So if you walk around in a headscarf or you walk around in a complete covering, if you're a woman, the chances that your daughters will are a little less. The chances that their daughters will are much less. But in the meanwhile, we deal with that assimilation thing. So we have to deal with the Muslim culture, which is basically unchanged since the 8th century. We have to deal with African cultures, which are basically unchanged in many, many years, despite the depredations of Christian missionaries. It used to be fairly easy to absorb the Germans and the Irish and the Jews and the Italians because they came in as big groups and they were recognizable to us. They were European. They really weren't all that different from us. But Yorubas and Muslims, it's a whole new equation. The Republicans ignore them. The Democrats absorb them. And then they get accused of kowtowing to special interests because they listen to the components of their support. I think I've run out of steam.
Well, no, I really appreciate your putting that out because it's sort of a context for this question of the difference between those two major parties and why it might be harder for the Democrats. I mean, that's kind of what we're looking at because people so often say they aren't doing anything. Well, instead of just saying they're feckless or they're bored or they're lazy or any of the things that people say, there may be real reasons, and I want to give people something else to chew on other than the common rhetoric of, oh, there go those darn old Democrats. There are deeper reasons why all this stuff is happening, and I want our listeners to be very intelligent about it. And to that, we might even add that on the West Coast, this was one I was thinking about after our conversation, on the West Coast alone, we have Asian, Native American, and Hispanic tendencies mingling in with the traditional culture, which also has a huge amount of migration from all over the United States. I mean, the West Coast is desirable.
So that's why we're here.
Right. You have a huge, huge melting pot at the west end of the country and all kinds of issues that come up with that. And when you've got people coming in who don't have money and need money, they will do what they need to do to get money, and sometimes that involves things that we might perceive as criminal, whereas they may perceive it as, I've got to take care of my family or something. So we have all sorts of problems, and the Democrats are the ones who tend to deal with the job issues and economic stability, and right now the Republicans have created a huge amount of economic instability, which is getting much worse. We'll talk about that in a minute. So here you have these cultures that are barely surviving, and you have two parties, one of which talks about making a difference and one doesn't care. These are the kind of things that need to be woven into these conversations that people have when they want to go ahead and blame the Democrats. So let's take that issue of economic stability, because this week the Senate did something really interesting in a very close vote, I think 52-48. They voted to raise the debt ceiling.
Oh, man.
To $9 trillion. Now,
yes.
Eddie, you're my expert here.
I am?
Well, yeah.
I've balanced my checkbook in 40 years.
Okay. The deal is that we are in such debt that they have to continually pass laws to raise the debt. Otherwise, we're in foreclosure. So I began to think to myself, what does foreclosure mean and what would it mean at this scale? What I came up with is that if we go into foreclosure, then does that mean that China can come and claim its $10 billion?
Yes, it can.
Can the Saudi Arabia come and claim its whatever percent it has of the U.S.?
They can call in their loans anytime
exactly.
they wish.
Exactly. And at that moment, it occurred to me that raising the ceiling is a temporary measure to bypass the reality that the country is owned by outsiders. Am I onto something here?
No, you're absolutely right. The cost of the war, which is hemorrhaging money at an incredible rate, trillions eventually, the trade imbalance where we're paying far more for goods than we bring in than we're selling to anybody else in the world, And finally, and most disturbingly, the fact that we're selling off our country in bonds to raise money because they've cut taxes on rich people who used to at least absorb some of the difference there and no longer do, that the burden is now in the middle and lower classes and that the revenue simply is not there the way it used to be. These loans can be, they're bonds. They can be called in at any time. If China really wanted to screw with us, they could do it. If we annoy China, China could say, okay, you owe me, you know, $700 billion in whatever it is. I'm making a number up. We want our money. You give it to us now or else. And the thing is, what do? You have
or
to sell
what?
That.
Huh? Or else what?
Or else what? I mean, I don't even know or else what. It's never really come to that.
China could come and say, okay, we're going to take California and Oregon and Washington because that's the equivalent of our what we own.
Well,
is that a potential?
I'm not sure it's real estate so much as or land so much as things.
Things, okay.
Industries,
we'll take the
buildings, the Empire State Building.
How about the Dubai ports?
Oh, sure.
So Saudi Arabia could be calling in some of its debt via the Dubai ports.
Oh, yeah. I think infrastructure. They could own the George Washington Bridge.
Right.
They could own the Seattle the tower.
And then what does that mean to us as citizens? In addition to the fact that everybody now owes $30,000 per head based on this debt.
What it means, in effect, is we're starting to lose control of our own country. They're becoming tenants in our own country.
So it wouldn't matter who we voted for at some point, because if somebody owns our utility, it's like a monopoly game.
It's out of control now.
Right. If somebody comes in and takes over all the utilities in the monopoly board and buys all the hotels, et cetera, even if we don't like them, they got everything.
If we don't like it, we go to jail. We go directly to jail.
Thank you. And people spy on us, maybe even.
Oh, maybe.
To find out who we are.
Hey, if you guys are listening, this could happen to you too.
Okay, we've also just written a nice space novel for somebody. But that raises another question, which is the data mining episode that's been talked about in some of the lesser media, but is now in the New York Times this morning on the business page. John Ashcroft, formerly the Attorney General, who bowed out with a gallbladder disorder, is now back as a lobbyist. And he, according to the New York Times article, one of his major clients is ChoicePoint, and ChoicePoint is known as a major data mining company. Data mining means that they basically collect data on consumers and their spending habits, which is sort of like spying when you think about it. And one of the things about ChoicePoint is that most of their contracts come from the government, which Mr. Ashcroft can facilitate. He facilitated that as the Justice Department guy, and now he's facilitating it because he knows how government works. So some 14-15% of their current contracts worth $1 billion are from the government, and they want more. So data mine, in fact, there was a case, this is what I remember, and I don't have all the details, but there was a case about ChoicePoint, that was supposed to go before the Justice Department, and I think once, former Attorney General Ashcroft became the lobbyist, he got the case dropped within 2 weeks, and I believe it was ChoicePoint. Mm-hmm. But there are other companies that are being taken into his company. One of them is eBay.
Yeah.
Another one is Israel Aircraft Industries International. Another is LTU Technologies, which is a software company to find more customers for visual imaging technology, which it sells to the FBI and customs officials. So that they're the people who hang up those cameras that watch us walk down the street. And then another one is certified public accountants. Now, that's interesting because these are the kind of people who do taxes.
Yes.
So when you start thinking about it on this level, here is Ashcroft making a big chunk of change doing this. He's also representing clients who are not unlike this foreclosure question we've raised, penetrating the sanctity, really, of our personal lives in this country with their technologies and making a lot of money to do it via Homeland Security contracts.
We have no sanctity anymore.
I've made myself sick this morning.
Yeah. The fact is that anytime you use your debit card, your credit card, you write a check, you're creating a paper trail for yourself that will follow you the rest of life. It's your permanent record, kids.
Mm-hmm.
Just parenthetically, on the issue of warrantless wiretaps, when he was still Attorney General, he was sick in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to him and said, we want you to authorize these warrantless wiretaps that the White House is asking for. And he said, I can't do this. If John Ashcroft couldn't do it, mm-hmm. I mean, what kind of, you know, this to me is the most astonishing factoid, trivia, piece of trivia about the whole warrantless wiretaps, is that not even John Ashcroft could countenance mm-hmm. them. So
we've been bought and sold down the river.
We've been bought and sold down the river. We are the most studied people on Earth. The only people whose daily lives may be in more trouble than ours are the Brits, because they have cameras everywhere, and we're just beginning to, we can't approach the saturation that the English have with cameras on the streets.
But we're getting there. By gum, we're in the game.
Those guys that blew up the transit, the buses and the subways in London, they got them all on camera because there are cameras everywhere in England. You can't scratch your ass in England without somebody taking a picture
of
it.
Well, that is the upside of camera technology.
Yes,
however, there is a downside, and then there's the civil liberties question of risk benefit. And
absolutely.
From my perspective as a citizen, the risk is too high.
I agree.
For the benefit, and I'm not saying that I support terrorism, of course, but it seems to me there might be other ways to do that, or selected places where you would do that, and that might involve utilities and transportation centers or hubs. But for average citizens on the street, I get a little queasy about that.
George Orwell, come home. All is forgiven.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Dubai then for a moment. Dubai, of course, was the port set up. The deal was that the United Arab Emirates would take control of 6 or 7 U.S. ports, mostly on the East Coast. The United Arab Emirates are one of the places from which 2 of the 911 hijackers come. As we know, the other 15 come from Saudi Arabia, which tells you a whole lot right there,
mm-hmm.
If you're thinking, really. But this package was apparently put together by Treasury Secretary Snow, who kind of rushed it through, which sort of fits with the analysis we talked about earlier about people calling in their chips, and this might be a way that Saudi Arabia is calling in one of its chips. Instead of a 45-day a check on the deal, it was a 30-day check. And a couple of things happened. One is the information came out that Dubai is a major investor in the Carlyle Group.
Yes.
Now, the Carlyle Group is?
Carlyle Group is an investment group. And the Carlyle Group, I'm not even sure who actually belongs to the Carlyle Group.
Well, it's Bush and Bin Laden families, that's for sure.
They're involved in it, yeah.
James Baker III. And one of the things about the Carlyle Group is that their investments are in military aerospace technology.
Absolutely.
So more wars are good for the Carlyle Group.
And they produce nothing except cash.
Yeah. And more wars make them richer.
Absolutely right.
And those are Bush's and Bin Laden's people. And that came out in the newspaper something like 3 days after 9/11.
Do you know about
Dubai?
Dubai is an interesting little place. The Muslim world needs a place where they can take off their jalabas and party down.
And have a beer.
It used to be Beirut, which was the Paris of the Middle East. But, of course, Beirut's a mess now, and you know, you can't do anything there anymore. It's no fun anymore. So Dubai is one of those places that sprung up to take the weight off the burden of being a Muslim. Mm-hmm. You can go there, you can have drinks, you can dance with women who are not your wife. You can appear in public with if you're a woman without escort. It's one of those places where rich Muslims can go and party and not have to feel bad, because then they can all go back to Cairo, they can all go back to Amman and you know, feel good about themselves.
And I think Michael Jackson lives in the United States.
Michael Jackson.
In the UAE.
Go figure. I mean, as strange as you think that man is, he gets stranger every day.
There are concerns because keeping little boys was outlawed in the early 80s in Saudi Arabia, as I recall from when I traveled there or when I worked there. But it didn't mean that it went away.
Yeah, that's right. There's a disconnect between like with many laws, what the law is and what the practice is. When you have a conservative culture that does not allow dating, that does not allow two married people even to see each other mm-hmm. before the engagement, then sexual energy has to go somewhere. And one of the places it goes is to the next generation of young men.
Right. Now, the Dubai people also are investors in Neil Bush's software company. And so
Neil Bush is a crook.
Yeah, so you begin to get a picture of the connections and the kind of good old boy slapping on the back that went on about this whole issue. But to me, there are two real questions about Dubai, because the president presumably didn't know, and then he did know, and he was surprised, and he heard about it on the news, all of which may be true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we may have people completely... forgetting to brief the president. Oh yeah, by the way, Saudi Arabia just, you know, took over the ports or something. But there are politics in this story and there are policies. Let's look first at this just as a, from a policy perspective.
Well, how so? What are you looking for?
What would it mean if we had a foreign nation in charge of our ports?
Well, it depends on the nation, doesn't it?
And England, this one with a connection to terrorism.
Yeah. What Bush says was when it was a great British company, I really love that, a great British company, nobody said anything, but now that it's an Arab company, everybody's saying something. Mm-hmm. Well, duh. I mean, you've for the last 5 years, you've told us how bad Arabs are and how bad, you know, it is to have to deal with radical Muslims, and then you turn over the port to a country from whom, which, by the way, was one of the three countries that supported the Taliban when they ran Afghanistan, and two of the hijackers came from the UAE. Chuck Schumer had a great resolution in the Senate that didn't go anywhere, but it was pretty funny. The resolution said no country that supported the Taliban can run our ports. And that was Saudi Arabia and UAE, and I forget who the third one was, but it's three of our quote-unquote friends in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So what it did, you know, it didn't go anywhere, of course, but what it was doing was just basically keeping the UAE out. How would we feel about Morocco or Algeria running our ports? I don't know. What I do know is that the fear of Arabs and Middle Easterners has been cranked up so much in this country that none of this would fly. And the reason I know this is because the entire Republican Party went into open revolt against this. This is the biggest setback to the Bush administration, I think, in the whole 5 years, is the fact that the Republicans are in open revolt against this Dubai port thing.
Well, that raises the second component of this question, which is the politics. Now, the whole question of the Republicans pulling out of the loop. One of the things that Tom Hartman talked about on Air America one day, which I thought was a really interesting take, and this was his idea, was that the Republicans pull away from an unpopular president over Dubai. Then when they campaign in the fall, because the president's poll points, I think his approval is now 29% in the latest CBS poll, and Cheney's favorable, unfavorables. His favorable is 18%.
The Republicans are admitting to 37%.
Well, yeah, well, that's not what everybody else is getting. But anyway, Hartman says, so you got the Republican candidates pulling away from the president, which they need to do because we're coming up on midterm elections. They get to go home to their constituencies and say, well, I sure wasn't with the president on that Dubai ports deal. They get reelected, and then they come back to Washington and do the same old thing.
It's called having it both ways.
Right. So the possibility is that the Dubai deal was set in motion to assist the Republicans to retain their hegemony over
Ooh.
The government. Or the other possibility is it was set up to trap Bush, which is a trickier way of playing the game.
It's so Machiavellian.
So Machiavellian. Yeah, but nothing is beyond anybody right now. So the question of politics in my mind is, what is the reality of the Republicans suddenly pulling away on just this particular issue, in your mind?
Well, with me, it's strictly poll numbers. It's yeah, what you said. It's strictly being able to say, look, this whole ports deal was a dung heap, and I had nothing to do with it. Okay, so you don't like the president? That's fine. You can reelect me because I had nothing to do with this ports deal. It was a big. This really laid on the American public like a wet blanket. It was just horrifying, the people's response to it, and horrifying to the Republican Party, because they've been used to just getting whatever they want from the electorate, mm-hmm. and now the independents, the ones, the swing voters, the ones that actually do elections in the fall, they are so off the Republican Party because of this that it's really quite amazing.
Well, let's jump across that big old continent over there, Europe and Asia, Iran. Mm-hmm. A lot of the rhetoric is now sounding a lot like it did pre-Iraq war.
Yes.
Condi Rice using language that is akin to her pre-Iraq war concerns, using terms like gravest concern to describe Iran. What do you think is going on with Iran, and what do you think is the deal?
Okay, the what we're supposed to believe, that is those of us who think about it, is that I can't even pronounce the new prime minister's name. I apologize for that, but I have Ahmadinejad. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. He could have been one of the people in the United States embassy when the embassy takeover happened in the 70s. He has a reputation as a radical. He's very, very radical and pro-imam, and pro-mullah in Iran. He's certainly a Shiite, as most of the people in Iran are. He has ideas about what should go on in Iraq, and certainly ideas about what should go on in Israel. He constantly calls for the destruction of Israel, wiping it off the map. And he claims that the United States has no business telling Iran what to do with their nuclear program, which is, of course, true. It's a sovereign nation. We have no business telling another sovereign nation to do what we tell them to do. So the United States, when it, you know, has no other options, is going to the United Nations and trying to get the United Nations to do its dirty work for it. But, you know, Iran is not buying it. Now, what we're supposed to believe is that there's a disconnect between what's going on in the government of Iran and what's going on the street in Iran. That on the street in Iran, people love the United States. They love the West. They say, oh, God, these guys are really, you know, they don't really make any, they're not the kind of people that we want to have running our government. But this guy was elected. So the truth is, I don't know what to think about what's going on in Iran. If we, all we can do is gauge them by the public pronouncements, and their public pronouncements are pretty dire. It's as bad as North Korea from the point of view of the American foreign policy, maybe worse.
Well, then a couple other thoughts come to mind when we talk about Iran, and one is that the best estimate is that it would be at least 10 years before they're ready to make nuclear weapons, which is interesting because North Korea already has them. So why are we going after Iran?
Good question.
So what do they have that we want? And the second thing is...
Is it black and come out of the ground?
I don't know yet. Iraq is descending into civil war simultaneously with huge amount of troop fatigue and...
The bodies, finding these 20...
Children. 50, they're finding children with
15,
their hands
20,
and feet
20, 30
found.
Bodies right. at a time in mass graves or just left in a pickup truck in one instance.
Right, and it's not really clear that it's the fault of any particular group.
It's Sunnis versus Shias.
It's not the fault of American soldiers. It's the general consensus. So our guys must be getting totally freaked out there.
Absolutely.
So we have troop fatigue. So who would actually go to Iran and fight this war? Which leads me to the next concern is, would we be using airstrikes, and are we getting ready to go in with airstrikes or nukes into either one of these areas? Any thoughts?
Yeah. My thought is that we never learned that airstrikes don't do anything except rally the troops, kill a few people, and make everybody else very angry.
So, unless you use really massive airstrikes.
Or nukes. And if you do that, whatever tiny hole the United States has left on integrity and on, being a moral force in the world is gone.
But what if we don't care because we're really not a country anymore? We're owned by everybody else.
Well, that's a really good question. The answer is I don't know.
The answer is I don't know. So we got to start being very Buddhist and living one day at a time, right?
Om Shanti.
Because, boy, are we in a tough spot. But, you know, I don't want our listeners to freak out about this, right?
we're freaked out. Why shouldn't they be?
Why shouldn't we be freaked out? What the heck? There's another story that popped up this week. I heard it on Al Franken on Air America. Two people, a guy named Michael Gordon and General Bernard Traynor, have written a book called Cobra 2.
Mm-hmm.
This relates to the Iraq issue. One of the concerns that they've come up with is that there's a real disconnect between the White House and the civilians involved in military planning and the actual military folks at the Pentagon. So that's like Rummy versus the Pentagon. And Rummy, by the way, I've been reading, he's flying around an airplane all the time now. His office is on a 747, and he's always flying around. He doesn't even land very much anymore.
Sounds like Dick Cheney a few years ago.
Very interesting, very interesting. But anyway, according to this story in Cobra 2, this is a story about the effort to create a de-Ba'athist policy. And this was known throughout the interior of the White House crowd, except for Colin Powell and Condi Rice. Presumably they didn't know or were being told they didn't know. But this was a way of control. One of the pieces of this de-Ba'athist policy, and of course Saddam Hussein was a Ba'athist, and so if you're de-Ba'athizing a country, you're trying to get rid of his people. But one of the things they did was they tried to control elections. So the military said here they were in Iraq. They were in a place called Najib. they had formed a relationship with the locals, which was one of their primary goals as military people in the region, to help bring democracy to Iraq, which was what they thought they were there for. And they formed this relationship with people. They said, we're going to have elections. We're going to help make sure that the elections run. And because the people ran a candidate that was not to the liking of the White House, the elections were canceled. And the military got freaked out because this was happening all over the place, apparently. And their concern was that here they established these relationships, and then they have to tell people we can't run elections, and then they lose the support of the people, and then their position becomes more dangerous. And apparently that's been going on for quite some time, which is yet another kind of wrinkle in our understanding of what's happening between civilian and actual military people. And I think that split with the Pentagon in the long run will probably be helpful to us as citizens if there's enough time.
Well, that may be true, but it's also very worrisome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And another thing that went on in Iraq, I think it's in this book, but this has been known for quite a while, is that when we invaded Iraq and we basically kicked the butts of the Iraqi army, who was not really that willing to fight for Saddam, but because they were perceived to be Ba'athists, they were cashiered. They said, you're fired. You're not going to get it. Your position in the army is over. You go home, but take your weapons with you. So what we had here was a disenfranchised, angry group who was armed with the best weapons in Iraq, and I think that they have helped fuel the insurgency. Not all of them, certainly, but if you have that big a group of disaffected, trained military, it's not a good idea. When you talk about the things which are not a good idea in the invasion of Iraq, this is way up there.
Well, we're getting close to the end of this segment, Eddie, and it sure is fun talking to you about this stuff, in spite of how lethal the
It gives me a chance to vent once a month.
Yes, that's what it's all about. And for people at home, you know, you can bang your fist on the table and, you know, kind of act
out. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it
anymore. I'm mad as hell, and I'm going to sit here and drink some more coffee. There's another thing that happened, and it's kind of a minor story, but it's also a reminder of where we are in this culture. For a long time in the advertising world, there have been a lot of critics of how advertising links a product to some kind of personal success. So if you brush your teeth, you get more dates. If you use the right deodorant, somebody will kiss you, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we've reached the point where Madison Avenue, or whatever that is now, is inverting, turning inside out, putting everything upside down, if you will. I saw a very interesting commercial on TV the other night about a Snickers bar. Now, here's the way it works. This guy goes up to the doorstep with a female who is obviously his date, and she refuses to kiss him goodnight and goes in the house. And it's all dull gray lighting. So the guy's really dejected, and he gets in his car. As soon as he gets in the car, he turns on the light, and there's a Snickers bar on the tray. He picks up the Snickers bar, and he has a really big smile on his face. He peels off the wrapper, and it looks slightly sexual to watch him do this. And out pops a tiny blonde with big bazooms.
Go on.
And the blonde says to him out of the candy bar, you big hunk of wonderful man, something like that. He gets this huge grin and he bites into the candy bar. And I looked at that and I thought, oh my God, they've completely co-opted the criticism and they've made the criticism part of the sale of the product now. We've reached that point where it's, you know, it's beyond Newsweek or Newsday or what was that 1984 line? Newspeak. We're beyond Newspeak. Then the second thing that came up was a new movie called Thank You for Smoking,
mm-hmm.
in which there's another inversion happening. The tobacco industry in this movie, which is based on a book, is basically saying we don't want to kill anybody with tobacco because these are our future smokers. Right?
Yes.
So I started thinking to myself, there's a whole inversion happening out there, and there's a culture of young people, and I work a lot with young people in a variety of capacities, and it occurs to me that their interests are really propelled by gadgetry and what is they feel compelled to buy, and they really have a disconnect from the kind of political and cultural issues that you and I are talking about right now. And I'm not being critical, it's just that life is hard, people are moving fast, and what really gets to be important is a cell phone that will take pictures, that will be a TV when you're driving in your car, and we'll do Lord knows what else, you know, we'll fly you in an airplane or something, I don't know. But these are the kind of things that start grabbing attention and start driving the equation of what kind of job you'll get, what kind of work you're willing to do. And so when one of these people is home at night, turns on TV and sees the guy with the Snickers bar and the cute blonde talking to him in the Snickers bar, it's got to be funny.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's making me crazy.
It's been this way through my whole life. I don't know how it was before I was born, but it's like the parents that don't spend any time with their children and make up for it by giving them money and stuff. This culture gives us nothing except money and stuff. And not everybody has access to that. So the people sitting there are made to want this money and stuff, which gets them with the program, because they want the cute little blonde, or they want the BMW or whatever it is that they're looking at. They've used sex to sell things forever and ever. It's funny you say Madison Avenue, because one of the biggest ad agencies in the world is Wieden & Kennedy, which is right downtown here in Portland. There is no Madison Avenue
anymore.
I know I'm
older.
That's such an archaic term. Gee whiz, we don't have much stake in this society anymore. We're feeling alienated, more alienated than we did in the late 50s and early 60s. And the 60s, at least in part, were created by alienation. We were alienated from a government that sent dogs on little children and sprayed nice people with fire hoses who were, all they wanted was the ability to vote and to go to school. I think we're approaching that again from a different angle, of course, but we're so alienating the people in our country that we're trying to buy them off. And we've always tried to buy them off, but now that's all we have to offer. There's nothing spiritual left at the center of this country anymore, despite the religious protestations and the Jerry Falwells of the world. This country is bankrupt emotionally and morally, and I don't know where to go.
Or people are beginning to assimilate a moral and ethical basis in ways that are not yet being tabulated in traditional religious ways.
So that's absolutely true. Things may be happening. We have no way
right.
to measure.
Like, we're going to talk to Howard Lyman in a few minutes, and there's a moral and ethical and spiritual dude who's concerned about the planet and the people on it. And
oh, my God, I had a hamburger last night.
Yeah, well, see, there's the thing. I mean, here's one of these people who is this, you know, this really angel internally, and it may be showing up in these other ways that aren't yet revealed in the popular culture, which is where we draw our hope. But
can I say something about,
sure.
We haven't seen Thank You for Not Smoking yet. The screening is next week. But this is from a book by Christopher Buckley. Christopher Buckley is the son of William F. Buckley. He's a very smart, funny guy, but he is right-wing. He's libertarian. I don't think he's not a doctrinaire Republican right-winger by any stretch of the imagination, but he is very anti-PC. And he wrote this book, Thank You for Smoking, from an anti-PC point of view several years ago now. The fact that they made a movie out of it is very amusing, and I haven't seen the movie yet. But remember that it is coming from a libertarian anti-PC.
Right.
It's satire. It's right-wing satire.
It's right-wing satire, and it's probably pretty good.
Probably pretty good.
Okay, so here's my final question in our last few moments. You and I talked about Purim?
Yes, Purim.
Purim. Which occurred on the day of the full moon lunar eclipse on Tuesday. And with that, you gave me an interesting story about being a kid growing up in a mixed religious community.
First of all,
what's the holiday?
The Purim is a holiday. It goes back to ancient Persia, where the Jews in ancient Persia were under threat. And one of the king's wives was Esther, who was Jewish and was a hidden Jew. And when the Jews became under threat, Esther went to the king Ahasuerus and said, I'm a Jew. If you kill the Jews, you'll have to kill me. So instead, he killed the bad guy, Haman, who was responsible for whipping up all this animosity to the Jews. And Esther saved the Jews. So you read the book of Esther, and it's a very happy holiday. It was described in the New York Times as, they try to kill us, they failed, let's eat and drink. That's one of those Jewish holidays.
And the mixed youth story, because my quote was, my question was, is religion a drug? And you gave me a story.
Okay, when I was a kid, I lived in a mixed Irish, Catholic, and Jewish neighborhood in Rockaway Beach, New York. And the Irish kids, I mean, I used to go to church with them. We would talk all the time. There was no animosity between us at all on a day-to-day basis. We played baseball together, blah, blah, blah. Two times a year. One time a year, and I'll give you another thing in a minute, which I didn't tell you before. On Good Friday every year, I had to hide. I couldn't go out of the house for fear of running into one of my Irish Catholic friends, because the nuns had whipped them into a froth on Good Friday, and they would come out thinking I had killed Jesus, and they would beat the crap out of me. So it was okay. Sunday morning when he was risen, I could come out again because everything was okay. But Good Friday, Holy Saturday, I had to basically make myself scarce. The only other thing I got beat up about was Joe McCarthy, because they all read the Hearst papers that were big Joe McCarthy supporters, like the Journal American, and I read the Post, which is labor liberal left-wing paper, and Joe McCarthy was a vile devil to them and a hero and a saint to the Irish Catholics. So I remember getting into a discussion with them once about the value of Joe McCarthy, and they kicked the crap out of me for that, too.
Well, Eddie, it's 9:59. We're tuned to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 in the FM band. This is the Electronic Salon. You are Eddie Goldberg. I'm Marlena Smith. We've been talking culture and politics. Any final thoughts, Eddie, because we're on the verge of that big holiday, that other holiday, which is, I think, the celebration of green beer?
No, it's today. Nobody in his right mind will drink a green beer, so don't do it. If somebody serves you a green beer, go get an Irish whiskey at the next bar. I'd like to say hello to my wife, Adele. We just celebrated our 28th anniversary.
Oh, congratulations,
Thank
Eddie.
You.
That's
that
real long
on the 13th.
Journey. Yeah, congratulations. Okay, well, listen, have a great day. Have a great weekend. Enjoy spring on Monday when it starts, and I'll see you next month.
Always a pleasure.
Take care, darling. We're going to take a little musical break, and then when we come back, I think we'll be ready for not only a few announcements, but probably to talk to Howard Lyman, the gentleman most associated with safety in beef, known as the Mad Cow Rancher.